Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. Today I'm joined by accomplished actor and filmmaker Frank V. Ross. He came to the attention of many in the independent film community with his role as Kelly in Joe Swanberg's web series Young American Bodies. And he made his directorial debut in 2003 with Oh My Dear Desire, an ensemble drama that he dubbed A Love Letter to Human Frailty. Which, I don't know, I saw that tagline and I had to repeat it. He has since then directed five more features, including 2010's Audrey the Trainwreck, which earned praise at the 2010 South by Southwest Film Festival. And on July 11th, two of Ross's films will be made, well, basically will be making their online premiere starting on July 11th. They're going to have a slow rollout over the next 3 days. Two of Ross's films, it'll be Audrey the Trainwreck and Present Company, making their online premiere on nobudgefilms.com, as well as a sneak preview of his latest film, Tiger Tail in Blue. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
I'm doing good, doing good. Now, we were talking about this a little bit before the show, but just in terms of this really annoying label of mumblecore, which everyone is kind of associating with these films. It's like you see a lot of micro-budget filmmakers, a lot of people making personal projects, a lot of sometimes improv-based films, and they're all very kind of intimate portraits of people. It's very, you know, realistic. And I was talking with Lynn Shelton when she was in town recently, and I said, if there really is anything that actually links these films that have the stereotypical label of mumblecore, and she hates that term like everyone else, it seems, like what unites them? And she said, I think it's really just the fact that none of us are waiting for permission to shoot a movie. That was kind of the way that she put it together. And I'm sort of wondering, just in your own view, I mean, do you kind of see yourself as someone who just is not, you're not waiting around to make a movie? You're just kind of...
I think before I plan out each film, mm-hmm. I've tried to get financing for films before. I've tried to make a film that was, you know, had a budget and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Adam Donaghy gave me money for Audrey after seeing Present Company. He just gave it to me. But I was going to make it regardless. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess, I have to make them because nobody's really going to finance them. I raised money on Kickstarter for Tiger Tail, but that was all friends and family. I might as well have just gone up and asked them for the money. I mean, I asked permission from my wife now.
Sure.
I'm shooting another film right now in piecemeal because there's no money for it. Mm-hmm. And I had to go to her and say, I'm going to make one more of these films just because I don't know why. Like, I just feel like I have to make another one. Mm-hmm. Feels right to make another one. So she's like, okay, whatever.
Well, it's because your films are very beautifully character-based. That's what I've really liked about your work that I've seen. And it seems like, there's a lot of these films with dialogue that doesn't necessarily move the plot forward in any kind of, you know, stereotypical way. It's the dialogue, there's a lot of nuances within the dialogue, and it's very character-based. And so I'm wondering what attracts you to kind of character-based filmmaking. If there's any other filmmakers that you've seen in the past that you kind of have taken a cue from, or someone where it's like, I kind of want to emulate that a bit.
Well, they all start, the reason why they're character-based, sort of excluding Oh My Dear Desire, like I've actually made a film before Oh My Dear Desire also. Mm. So my third feature, Quietly on By, is the first one that I was ever proud of. Mm-hmm. And it all stemmed from the image of three people making a tire swing that I saw when I was walking. Mm. And then in order to get the characters that were interesting, it's just people that I saw and I don't know. And they're all real people that I know, that I know most of them. So, you know, I'm not saying their names or anything, but it always starts from the image of a person, and then sort of my imagination of that person runs wild. Mm-hmm. Like Audrey the Trainwreck was my UPS lady. Mm. And I don't think that's what her life is at all. It's just I wanted to make a movie about a lady who delivers stuff.
Sure, sure.
And a guy that I was talking to at a party who had just a really bad goatee, and I wasn't comfortable talking to him, mm-hmm. and I knew he wasn't married, and I didn't know much about him. But I wanted to make a film about him because I think he's interesting. Mm-hmm. Or it interests me. I don't like when people say that it's interesting. It interests me. There's like almost like a fetish of just people just looking at people and then assuming shit about them, I guess. Mm-hmm. Is sort of what it is. Like Audrey the Trainwreck, for example, her name's Audrey too, which is kind of fucked up. But I saw her, and I hadn't talked to her in years, and I saw her and she looked terrible. And I was talking badly about her, mm-hmm. and I felt like a jerk. I was like, "What? I don't know. I've been fall down drunk before too, you know." And if somebody judged me based on that,
sure.
I would be really mad. So, if you can sort of take just that idea of seeing someone you haven't seen in a long time and making an assumption about them and then feeling bad about it. Mm-hmm. Because if somebody did that to you, you would feel terrible. That's how each movie starts. Mm. Present Company was, well, he's never going to hear this. A guy I went to high school with, Brandon, who knocked up a girl, and then they got married and had to live in the parents' basement. Mm-hmm. I mean, she miscarried, so they never actually went through with it. They, you know, they didn't have the baby holding him together, but that's what the film was about. That's mm-hmm. who I was playing him. You know, like mm-hmm. you watched it, like I'm kind of like, yes. He's a dick. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was doing. And I think jerks are interesting because people just put up with them and they don't see what they cause around them and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, considerate people are boring because they're considering everything around them, whereas jerks just sort of plow forward.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's my rambling answer to that.
Well, no, because I was reminded some of the De Niro Scorsese characters of someone who just is kind of blind to the signals around him and just kind of just charging through his life, and I kind of saw a similarity with your character in Present Company, and I think you feel a certain empathy for these characters where it's like you know you are judging them. I mean, you are kind of like taking a preconception you have of a person, kind of a germ of an idea, and then creating a character from that. But I feel empathy for all the characters in your films because they're all kind of struggling with this kind of identity where it's like you know this guy had a child very young, you know, with this woman, and it didn't seem like they were really, you know, meant to be together. And so they're both kind of struggling with, well, you know, I want to still hang out with my friends. I still kind of want to get out of the house. And there is this just kind of tug happening between them. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like, that's one thing that distinguishes some of these films that are so character-based is that the people are so real that you can't just dismiss them. You can't just kind of, you know, look at them and just kind of caricaturize them in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always kind of what I've found interesting about that. But just getting to a little bit about your earlier work, you said you did a film before Oh My Dear Desire. What was that film? Because I'm just going strictly off of the IMDb postings, everything like that.
I just never even registered it, but I feel bad denying that it exists because I stopped going to – I was going to COD, mm-hmm. and I stopped going to make the film, and it's terrible, and it cost more money than any film I've ever made. Mm. And I learned a lot making it.
You know? Sure.
I learned how to not spend money, the right way to ask for favors. I learned how to cast people, you know, and not cast people. I learned that exposition is the worst frickin' thing in the world to put in a movie. You know, so you'll know, like, I use a lot of objects, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. because I hate exposition. I don't know, you know,
well,
people
sure.
explain what's going on, you know. So that was... That was the first film that I made. That's all that was. It's called A Story in a Life.
Oh, okay.
So if you can imagine a 17-year-old kid making that, I was just the smartest person in the world.
Yeah. Well, and there's no problem with shooting for the stars early in your career, and you have to make certain mistakes, you know, to really refine your voice and figure out what you want to do. And mm-hmm. and that's one thing that I admire about your films is there is a lot of dialogue, and there's a lot that you can take from the dialogue and really kind of it gets more into the characters than if it was just exposition that they were just kind of spouting out. And I think people like Tilda Swinton said in an interview recently, she said, I love films that are all talk but nothing's really said. Or it's really just kind of all under the surface. And I think that really allows really great showcases for your performers. I mean, there's some wonderful showcases for some of the actresses in your films in particular that mm-hmm. I think are really great. So there really was no, in particular, like a certain type of filmmaker that you saw and you're like, I'd like to try something like that. This was all just kind of you experimenting with your own voice and kind of figuring out what you wanted to do, these kinds of...
Well, I never had a problem with like an anxiety of influences or anything like that mm-hmm. because I just started watching movies and I started like looking at textbooks because I wasn't in school and I misinterpreted so much of it, you know, for my first film. Mm-hmm. It was a swing and a miss. I just didn't get it. I wasn't smart enough to teach myself, and so I made another film and I taught myself a lot and I started watching films that made more sense to me. And I can't name it. Like The Bicycle Thief made a lot of sense to me. Like mm-hmm. I found like, oh, this is a movie. Okay, got it. Because everything is, you know, what are like the five, you know, film school films?
Sure.
Name them.
Oh, well, I mean, and it all depends on what film school you go to.
No, there's five.
Okay, there's five.
What are they?
What are they? Okay, Casablanca, okay. One of those.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
There's no wrong answer.
There's no wrong answer?
Yeah.
For me, All That Heaven Allows was another
okay.
that we watched quite a bit. Anything by Scorsese,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
George Romero,
mm-hmm.
I watched Cassavetes. I mean, Cassavetes is one that people try to attribute to some of these newer, you know, micro-budget films, some of your work or some of Joe Swanberg's work. But when I asked Swanberg, he said he never really even watched Cassavetes. So
no.
There's really
I gave him faces, and he watched, like, the first 20 minutes, and then he got a phone call and just sort of...
And that was it. That was it.
I mean, because, his films, sure. You know, I love, like, the close-ups and the behavior in them. I feel like that's really important. I try to get behavior in my films. I feel like you learn a lot more than just people talking or, like, clever dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm sort of steering... I think I'm going to start steering away from it. But that's neither here nor there. Why did I say that? but I watched Cassavetes' movies for the first time. I saw... Woman Under the Influence, and then in the same week I saw 8.5, and then I watched The Bicycle Thief, and then I watched Julian Donkey Boy, so that was all in like just 1 week, and I'm like, you can do whatever you want, can't you? You can just do whatever seems right to you, and that's when I started just taking things that I liked to see, images that I wanted to see, and then just getting them into a script and sort of crafting them into a story, and just always choosing what I think is what feels right at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever felt right at the time. Like, how are we going to do this? X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. Just feels right. So it just made it very, very easy for me to realize you could do whatever the hell you want in a film.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that so this first film that you made at 17, and so that was before you really had any kind of. I mean, did you have any kind of like formal like film school training, or was this all you just all kind of been working as your own?
I went to a multimedia class. It was called Davy at the time. I don't know what it's called now, but you got out of the last few classes. Mm-hmm. And I was in a band at the time, so I was interested in like audio production and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we did that, and that's where I learned everything, and then. I met the guy who shot my first film. He still shoots in Chicago. We didn't get along well because I was really full of myself and like just very, very arrogant for no reason. And I got a lot of that out of my system in the first two films.
Sure, you know? Sure.
And then was just able to do what I wanted to do instead of doing what I think would impress people. Mm. You know, like trying to impress people, which is what the first two were. Trying to be like, look how fucking good I am at this. Yeah, it comes naturally. I didn't go to film school.
That's right.
That's how it was.
Well, everyone has a different journey, and I feel like the tendency with some people in film school is that you just learn so much about the other filmmakers, the way they've made things, that it's hard to kind of find your own voice. You just end up kind of imitating other people, using their blueprint and not really making your own, it seems.
Right.
What seems like the big difference there. And so basically, your role, what do you think the role of collaboration, you know, plays in your work? Because it seems like you really, Anthony J. Baker has been in a lot of your work. And it seems like, do you feel comfortable kind of cultivating a group of people that you like working with? But you also, I mean, you bring in new people as well. But is there a benefit to that kind of like the sustaining a collaboration with someone, picture to picture?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean... I don't really have a good answer for that. I like using some of the same people because I know that they'll show up.
Sure, sure.
You know.
Did you know Anthony for a while before you started making films?
Oh, yeah.
Was that okay?
Oh yeah. We were in that band together.
Oh okay.
You know that we started doing the thing for. So.
Yeah.
And then, and being friends, it was almost nonverbal, sort of thing. And I always let. And learning, like going from that, working with people that you like know as friends, like you already know what they're gonna do, you know. And then when they don't, they surprise you, and you learn a lot when you start working with people that you know very, very well. And you learn that you just need to let people do it the way they want to do it first.
Sure.
You know, I don't. It turns me off when an actor asks before they do it a question. Mm-hmm. You know, so I just say, you know, do it how you want to do it, and then we'll work from there. You know, because in the, like I said, like the way I go about making a film is just whatever feels right. So I don't know what it is yet until you do it. And then ultimately, like I write by myself, like I'm in a room writing by myself, making stuff up. And it would be retarded to bring people, all these talented people to help you do this thing and then execute exactly what you did when you're just sitting in your room by yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, like they're supposed to bring more to it. You know, so I lost the question in there somewhere. No, but I said
But see, that's fine. It's, yeah, because you brought up an even better point where it really I think that's what makes your films very rich is because you can sense this art of collaboration. Like, I mean, there's some great scenes in Audrey the Trainwreck with Danny Rhodes. You know, so some of his lines, and I mean, I feel like you kind of get a sense of the different personalities, you know, of the actors working within the material, and really kind of it's kind of upping everyone else's game. I think when everyone's kind of firing on all cylinders, creatively speaking. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, because you've done some acting as well. I mean, the first thing I saw you in was Young American Bodies and then Autoerotic. And I'm wondering, those experiences as an actor, has that in any way, you know, enhanced your own approach to working with actors or directing? And was acting something you've always been doing as well?
Acting is what I wanted to do. That's okay. Why I made the first film. That's why. And then I just really liked... I've always been a writer. I've always written.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to be, and I wanted to be Billy Crystal, and kind of still do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I wanted. That's what I started off wanting to do, and then I just started making films because I really like it. I like the sense. I love editing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love the rhythm of editing. I love the sense of editing. I love the mechanics of it and all of it. It's my favorite part of it, and I love. I really like writing scripts. It's fun for me to like make an outline and write the dialogue. I'm working on a script right now, and I picked up. I wasn't sure if I had a continuity thing right, so I picked up the script and read it, and I made myself laugh. Like, I didn't have any recollection of writing. I was like, "That's funny."
It's always a good feeling.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's a nice feeling. Yeah. So probably, I guess, yeah. I would like I'd treat them how I'd want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't like the way that I would like to be treated, I treat them how they want to be treated.
Sure, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, with Present Company, that will be premiering, I think it's on July 12th?
It's the first one.
Okay, July 11th. So it'll be on July 11th. And this is a wonderful film. This is a film that I found kind of painful to watch at times because it's so brutal in a sense. It's more just kind of like emotionally brutal, I felt, with these characters because, as we mentioned before, it's this young man and this young woman, and they had a child together. They didn't get married. And that doesn't say, you know, you don't need to get married in order to have a stable relationship. But you could tell that there was something where this child just kind of came of a certain night, you know, that just randomly tended to happen, and then their relationship never really, there was nothing really beyond that, it seems. And he's kind of living at her parents' house,
mm-hmm.
and so you can sense all this tension between these people, and you play the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what that's like directing yourself, if that's something that you, does that have an added challenge in a film when you're directing yourself, or is that kind of...
What you said was really interesting about, like, you can describe you sort of have the backstory
mm-hmm.
of the film. Nobody says any of that in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You just get that and then assume that.
Exactly.
And that's something that is very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I've done my job as a filmmaker because you can do that. I love it when people just, make shit up
yeah.
about the backstory. Like, they get it because
mm-hmm.
those are people that are behaving in a certain way. And when people are behaving, you judge them, you make assumptions.
Yes.
I love that. I love making assumptions about people. And I think that's what appeals to you in the movies, is that you can make assumptions about them. And then your question was?
Well, just in terms of directing yourself.
Directing yourself, right.
Yeah.
You know, especially because it was Tammy. Tammy plays my baby mama.
Mm-hmm.
She crewed on Quietly on By.
Mm.
And I just liked her a lot. And I wasn't going to make the film Present Company. It was a different movie. It was about like a musician and like, I had her drowning the baby at a certain point, and mm-hmm. I didn't want to make that movie anymore. I wanted to make like a really quiet movie about two people who just were locked in this situation and
mm-hmm.
mad at each other, you know. And I said to Carrie, that's my wife's name's Carrie. I said, I want to make a movie with Tammy, and she's like, that's a great idea. So I wrote the script and called Tammy, and I was like, I want to make a movie. And she's like, yeah, it's great. And she read it, and I'm like, do you relate to it? She's like, yeah, it's my nightmare. And acting with her and being in the scene, I don't want to say control it, but you can set a tone mm-hmm. when you're actually acting in your own scene. You can set the tone. You can control it. You can I mean, I'm always worked out ahead of time. Like, I have my mm-hmm. notes and stuff so that when I go and I reference it real quick, I write notes to myself or remember to do a line a certain way. Like, I write it all down so I don't have to think about it because I will forget.
Mm-hmm.
So directing myself, I guess I do it alone on paper so that when I'm shooting the film and there's all that problem solving that has to be taken care of, I can just go back to my notes and be like, okay, right, yeah, I'm doing this, I'm behaving this way.
Sure.
And then, I mean, what suffered in that particular movie is that I had to corral, because I had shot Hohokam by myself and put lavs on the actors. They were like their own audio guys. Like, I was the one, I was the only crew member mm-hmm. on Hohokam. We shot it in like 9 days.
That was the film you did right before this.
Right before that, yeah. So I wanted to act. I missed it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I had, like, Swanberg shot some of it for me, mm-hmm. and then Anthony shot some of it for me. I shot some of it, and then a friend who's a news photographer shot some of it. And I assigned them all their own part of the film.
Yes.
So that it would have some sort of thing. And then a lot of people just really criticized the way that it looked.
Mm.
So, like, the film suffered in not asking for permission, like you said before,
mm-hmm.
and in making it because I felt like I had to, and acting in it, that's how that film suffered. Does that make sense?
Sure,
but
sure.
I mean, I really like it. I think it's my best one. Like, it's so your regular standard story, like your first, second, and third act movie.
It's a very powerful emotional arc, I felt. And as you say, I mean, yeah, it's true. It's like everything I said, it's not told to you, but I feel like sometimes a narrative like that doesn't tell you all of the extraneous, you know, expository details, that has a more powerful resonance. It's almost like the audience can own it more because mm-hmm. then now the story's kind of growing in their own head. And I'm wondering, when you are acting with, you know, someone like Tamara, you have to have this whole past with her. Is there any discussion about the past, like prior to shooting? Or is there any kind of, like, where was our relationship prior when we had this child? Any kind of discussion? Or is that really just kind of...
I tend not to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's important. Sometimes, you know, you just need to know, well, like, how do we know each other? You know what? You went to high school together and you were good friends, and now you just see each other at showers and birthdays and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of stuff you need to know. Discuss? I don't think so. I don't think you need to discuss it. People are smart. They can, you know, make up their own. You know?
Sure.
But, like, Alexi going to the shower, who doesn't know anybody in Audrey when she goes to the shower.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Jenny and Sasha are in that scene, and they just tore it up because those are all my aunts and cousins and stuff. And they were all just being loud, and Alexi just had to sit there and, like, not participate.
Mm-hmm.
And she did need to know, like, what is our relationship? They both did need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And it's okay not to assume it because they both needed to know the same thing because they have that scene later when they talk. So it's just said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm like, do you have a friend like that? And they're both like, yeah. I was like, okay, that's what we're doing here. They got it. High five, moving on.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And can you tell me how to pronounce that last name? Is it Alexi?
Wasser.
Wasser. Okay, because I immediately recognized her from the girls' pilot in Art School Confidential.
Mm-hmm.
And she has great eyes. I mean, she has the kind of eyes where you can see a whole world going on in there.
Yeah.
And, okay, so with Audrey the train wreck, it's a fast... And so it's basically her, and it's also Anthony Baker in that as well. And it's these two people who... are sort of they're both. It seems like there's a lot of angst in not just in your films, but just in a lot of films made by you know 20 something, you know, 30 something filmmakers trying to get at a certain angst of the current generation, and not like self-consciously making a film about the generation, but just about people, you know, who have to deal with kind of like the economic turmoil this time, the kind of, you know, dealing with crappy jobs, being in this kind of cycle of just, you know, it's like they're in a routine that they have to break in some way, where it seems like that's one thing I can see in all three films that I saw was that these people seem to be stuck in this cycle that they need to break, or maybe that they don't need to break. It's just like it's kind of commenting on this routine in a way.
Yeah. That's big to me. That's always very important to me because that's what your life is made up of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember Mike, every day he gets a coffee at the gas station. He gets his coffee every day at the gas station. I had no idea. And he's been doing that for like 17 years. And I've known the guy for like 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I never see that. It's mind blowing to me that you go and you say hi to the gas station guy and I don't get to see it. It's mind blowing in like the most 17-year-old way of saying mind blowing. That's
sure.
how I mean that.
Sure.
I mean that in a very adolescent way. And sometimes I think, you know, you grow out of those things, like thinking that certain things are amazing, you know. you grow out of that, and I don't know, just trying to hold on to it a little bit. Like this, so that's why he gets the coffee and Audrey, and you know, he's making the routine and doing it. And you know, my sister-in-law was a big inspiration for that. Like, she's a purchaser. That's
okay.
The job that he has.
Yes, an ATM purchaser.
Yeah. Right. Because she's in a routine. Mm-hmm. And you can see her, you know, some days she's just so mad about it, and some days she's okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time, she didn't have a boyfriend or anything like that. And it's like, God, it's like fucking impossible to meet people if you live in the suburbs and you have a job.
Mm-hmm.
Because you hang out with the same people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And bars are, everybody in the bar sucks. And friends of friends, it's like, it's weird to be set up and stuff like that. So that Audrey's about internet dating.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the film is about.
Mm.
You know, and you only see them on the computer once, but that's
sure,
you
sure,
know.
Yeah.
But I mean, people already assume that they're online dating. They assume
exactly.
It.
Exactly, because he's meeting various women at the same
right.
cafe and everything.
Right, so you
yeah.
just put it there. So, I mean, yeah. So that's what the movie's about. That's what that movie's about and stuff like that. So there, I lost your question again, man. I'm
well,
sorry.
Well, no, I said this is not about questions. It's just
okay.
about discussion. You mentioned that you like to focus on objects. And there's a lot of visual things in Audrey that I found interesting, where it's kind of focusing on this loose egg that's just kind of rolling in a refrigerator that, you know, will eventually end up on the floor. And there's a certain tension that you create with the images without really drawing, you know, too much attention to it. You just kind of see it every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what that component was that attracted you to the film, as far as, you know, these things happen in threes is a title that we see right at the beginning. And this idea of kind of like cosmic, you know, incidents that kind of rupture the routine, I guess, mm-hmm. kind of wake people out of their slumber. I was wondering what attracted you to kind of focusing on those moments, or at least kind of having the narrative, you know, it isn't really structured to those moments, but they're, you know, they kind of come in at certain points.
It was just, I was editing a movie, and when I take breaks, at the time, I was living at my mom's house. At the time, we had a dartboard in the garage, and so I would throw darts to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go out, have a cigarette, and throw darts. And I thought it'd be funny to open up a movie with somebody getting hit in the back with a dart,
yeah.
and then they go to the house, and then that's sort of like picking your character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the movie could be about anybody in here. Ding!
Sure.
You know, it's that one. And then the joke being, like the banana peel on the
sure.
ground, the egg,
the water that spilled,
the water that spilled, mm-hmm. just all that stuff. The girl running with scissors,
sure, yeah.
and stuff. It's just a joke, because you're waiting for what's the second thing? Oh, the flat tire.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, it gets thing, then he gets a flat tire. These things happen in three, so you're waiting for the third thing,
mm-hmm.
and then the third thing happens, and it's boom. That's the end of the movie, you know.
Yeah.
So that was it. That was the whole joke. And sculpting it so that it would be. I hate the way movies about like new relationships end, because especially when I was younger, I hate it. I was like, do you think they're going to work out, or, you know, what happens next? It's like the next thing they're going to do is go to the hospital.
Yeah, sure.
You know what the next thing this couple is going to do. Like,
yeah,
they're not riding off into
the
sunset, and it's so ambiguous as to what's going on. It's like, this is what's going to happen next after the movie sort
mm-hmm.
of thing. So that's all. It's just a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Just a joke. But, you know, putting the characters in a structure, like the film knows that it's a movie and it's structured that way, and,
mm-hmm.
but you're still putting characters that are rich and funny and specific in it and stuff. And
absolutely.
All that, yeah.
Yeah, but it also seemed, because it is a joke, it is kind of a running gag in the film, but it just seemed to have a deeper feeling to me that all of a sudden it wakes these people up in a way, where
mm-hmm.
it's this sort of dealing with complacency in society. I know the characters tend to talk about the complacency, where they're kind of, there's a line in Tiger, Tail, and Blue, when I think it's Anthony again saying something about reality TV, where he gets really irritated, people just kind of like nodding along with responding mechanically, I suppose, to
mm-hmm.
just kind of like the contrivances of reality TV. And I'm wondering if any of that is reflective of your own thoughts of complacency, or do you think that's almost kind of like a comment on the character's own? It's like they're stuck in complacency, but they're kind of judging at the same time.
Oh, you like themselves being like unaware that,
sure,
that,
or just
that
whatever,
they're part
yeah.
of what they're complaining of? Yeah. I mean, for when Tony's talking about reality TV at the end of Tiger Tail, I just it was originally about health insurance. I wrote this long thing about health insurance, and I was just trying to think of what's the most irritating thing to listen to people talk about. Like, he just comes in, it just breaks the fantasy of where they are at the time and just ruins the moment and just looks fucking crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I think Swanberg saw it. He said he looks like he belongs in a Miami Vice episode or something.
Yeah.
And, that's all. So that's it. I was just trying to think of the most irritating thing to listen to.
Sure. You know,
and yeah, of course. I mean, does he watch reality TV? Doesn't he? Who knows? It's just an annoying thing to listen to. But people complain about when I hear people complain about things on TV, they always sort of qualify it with, and I don't even watch a lot of TV, but this is a good show, or I can't watch that stuff. It's so stupid. You know, like just, I don't know, I'm like, why are you even talking about it? Is this a thing that we talk about, you know? Like, I would rather, I don't know, do shots or something and talk about death.
Sure.
Than listen to you talk about, you know, and they always know so much, too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, that one, her husband, he killed himself. Yeah. In real life.
And again, you're talking again about making assumptions where it's like, you know, well, I got this guy figured out because I watched them on reality TV.
Yeah.
And it's just making all the judgments about their lives.
I don't like her. As far as, it was the day after the Oscars, I was in a diner and there was these two old ladies talking about, Angelina Jolie, I guess, presented.
Oh, yeah.
She presented an award. Mm-hmm. And this old woman goes, and that Angelina Jolie, who she thinks she is? like that. Like, what? Like, what did Angelina Jolie do
context?
At the Oscars? Yeah. And I saw a picture, like, she was wearing a dress or something like that. And
yeah.
I don't know, it was that. So that was also sort of important.
Sure, just kind of like the mindless water cooler discussion.
Yeah, I hear stuff. I write stuff down all the time. You know, like, I hear stuff and write it down. I probably have some in the notebook in my back pocket. Mm-hmm. This East German guy walked into the post office the other day, and he was on his Bluetooth, and maybe we can go up to Starve Rock, have lunch, whatever. It was just the way he was saying, like, whatever. I'm
sure.
Like, I have to do that. Just go there, have lunch, walk around, whatever.
Exactly.
So that was that.
Well, I feel like one thing that these films do is it brings more empathy to some of these people. Again, as I said, that you would rather dismiss, you know, and I feel that a lot of the, you know, it's fun in Audrey because it seems like the person that you feel the most for is the person who's adrift in the conversation. There's all these conversations overlapping all the time, and it seems like it's the person that kind of feels lost or a bit adrift. You know, those two main characters, and then they end up kind of meeting.
Right, right. Yeah, that's, yeah. I really like having people talk around the main characters and focusing on it and stuff. Just, you know, I grew up in a family that everybody talks at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can cope in that. Like, I know how to do it. You just start talking over them, you know. But it used to give me, like, panic attacks and stuff when I was little, like really little, like if I could, like nobody could hear me because it was just so loud, you know. And I had like night terrors and stuff a lot when I was a kid, of like being really really small and like, things crushing me, and wake up screaming and everything. And that's, and the two are like the same thing in my mind, and that's why I really like those hectic scenes just for that reason, because it's like that's how I actually see shit, you know, like very. Everything's just all over the place all the time. You
sure,
know?
Absolutely.
So,
and you have empathy for the people who are lost in that storm,
right?
You know, conversation. And there's even one scene where it's like the main characters are talking in Audrey at just like a table in a restaurant, and you actually cut to another couple. I think it's Chris Swanberg and someone else.
And Lonnie, yeah.
Just kind of talking, and it's just interesting how it's like certain conversations just, you know, dominate
even
when he's in the midst of his own.
Well, I was sitting in somewhere in public, and these two people were talking, and I thought they were on a date. And it turns out that she was selling him real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing Audrey at the time, or he was interested in buying real estate. And I was writing Audrey at the time, and it changed the entire script, you know, because it's like this small talk needs to be much more specific.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and it needs to sound like they're selling real estate, so I just straight up put it in there.
That's cool.
You know, just to just to show you, you know.
Yeah, so. That was a detail that really stuck out to me. And then in Tiger, Tail, and Blue, and I don't want to talk about that too much because it hasn't gotten released yet. But there's so much I could talk about in this film. I think it's one of your most fascinating, if your most fascinating film. I can't say that as an expert because I haven't seen the first couple.
But you can talk about it.
Sure. Yeah, because I think that. Well, first of all, it's a wonderful showcase for this Rebecca Spence. I'm wondering how you met her, how you kind of.
She's the first date in Audrey the train wreck.
That's right.
If you notice that. That's her. And I met her through Allison, who's in Hohokam, which you didn't see.
I've seen her in other things, though, too. Allison Lada?
Lada. Hohokam was her first film, and she's my favorite. And Rebecca and her are friends. And because I had money with Audrey, the obstacle that I put in front of myself was to work with people I'd never worked with before.
Mm-hmm.
So like I just called Rebecca and I'm like, I want you to do this part or this part. She's like, I don't have time for this part. I'm like, okay, great. So she showed up. That was the first time I met her. They did the scene. I thought she was excellent. And I bumped into her I was shooting a film with Joe while we were shooting Caitlin Plays Herself. I bumped into her at that farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not taller than me. And I remembered her being taller than me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized that she wasn't, I was like, we should be in a film. Like, I could totally write a film for her. I'm not doing, she's taller than me. No, you're out, man.
Sure.
So I wrote it for her, and she was planning on quitting her day job and just focusing on acting full time. I was like, great, well, we're going to make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully people will see it. Yeah, she's really great.
Yeah, well, it's there's something in this film where your character because you actually it seems like they are kind of, you know, an official couple, a much more official couple, I suppose, than like present comedies. He's living with this woman.
They're married.
They are married. Mm-hmm. They are married, but they never see each other. He's always right. You know, they're always working. One person's working the day shift, one's working the night shift,
mm-hmm.
and. It's so fascinating because it seems like, in a way, you're kind of cutting back and forth between flashbacks of them working together, him and his wife at this restaurant, with kind of a more some more warmer tones in those scenes, and then it's kind of a more desaturated look for
Mike Gibbiser would kiss you on the mouth.
Well, that was what I noticed. It reminded me in a bit of a way, a bit stylistically, cinematically speaking, with Blue Valentine a bit, where it's a bit warmer tones in the scenes where it's a bit of a flashback and then more desaturated when it's him and they're kind of separate. They don't really see each other very much.
Right. Yeah, that was all because it was that's how we wanted it to do. We wanted it to play like we were flashing back, but then it turns out. Twist, you know.
I don't want to talk too much about the twist, but it is fascinating because you're really getting this relationship at two totally different times. Again, almost in that way, like it reminds me of Swanberg's Nights and Weekends too, where it's like two different times in this relationship,
right?
You know, the courting and then the aftermath,
right?
But again, and you don't really know exactly where the couple's going. It's just a beautiful way of looking at both sides. And John Medeski, I have to ask about him and Chris Speed. The music in this is beautiful. And I'm a clarinet. I mean, I played clarinet through school. And it's the most melancholy version of Auld Lang Syne I've heard in a while.
Isn't it the best version? It's the best version of Auld Lang Syne ever recorded.
Yeah. So well, I'm wondering how you got involved with him, because Medeski also did
Audrey, the
music in that. And so what attracted his approach to music?
I learned so much about acting, just like acting and filmmaking and behavior, watching Medeski, Martin, and Wood play on the stage together. Like watching them communicate while playing music is a masterclass in how to fucking act.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is how you communicate without speaking, you know. And I'm a fan. I'm just a fan, and I think he's one of the greatest piano players of all time. And I contacted him about Present Company, and we ran out of time, and we weren't able to do it. We weren't able to get it together. And I contacted him just as a fan, you know, and was dealing with his manager and stuff. And I think the way I wanted to do it appealed to him, the way I wanted to just sit down and, like, you know, I think, well, all the music for Audrey was recorded in about 6 hours, and all the music for Tiger Tail was recorded in about 4, I think. Because they know what to do.
Sure.
Like they can play, man.
Yeah.
You know, like John can play. And like for Audrey, he would just play. And I was like walking around in circles, jumping up and down. I have some of it on tape, and I don't look cool. I look like an idiot.
Sure.
But I contacted him in San Francisco. We ran out of time, and then unbeknownst to me, he had watched the movie and liked it. And then I contacted about Audrey way ahead of time, and we had it all scheduled and everything like that. And he was in the loop more.
Oh, okay.
And we went to their studio, and his piano was there, and we just banged it out.
That's beautiful music. Is this anything that you would ever think would be on iTunes or any like snippets of the music? Or does he have any music that's available?
John?
Or, yeah, anything like that.
Tons,
yeah.
Yeah, just Medeski, Martin, and Wood.
Okay, that's right. Well, I guess I meant just more specifically like any of his film scores
you'd
write for film. Okay. Yeah.
You know, Soderbergh had a good idea of just holding on to it and like just putting together like a compilation of it and of all this stuff and letting him have all the money from it just as like a thank you, but I want more because that's sort of like the side effect of it is I have all of this great original John Medeski music that I can listen to whenever I want, and I listen to it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's my alarm clock, like my alarm clock plays a Stacey's theme, like
nice.
That's what I wake up to,
sure.
In the morning, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, one of these days I'll put it all together for him and
Very cool.
Put something out.
Well, my last question for you on No Budge, I just want to know exactly how you sort of got involved with them and what led to this, you know, Frank Ross week that they're putting together.
Well, I've known Kentucker for a long time. I met him in the green pastures of Harvard University when they were showing.
Kentucker, oddly, the actor, filmmaker.
Yes.
The one
and only.
The one and only.
I met him at Harvard when they were showing a team picture and Finding Lillian and Dan and... Randy Walker's movie made a really good movie.
Okay.
I'll look it up. Yeah, it's that year. I cannot think of the name. And they were showing Quietly on By. So I met him then, and I'm very sexually attracted to him. And we, you know, kind of kept in touch and stuff. And then we met up again in New York when they did the IFC thing, the new talkies thing. And we've just always been in touch. And it was his idea. He just really wanted to see Tiger Tail.
Mm-hmm.
In blue, and I sent it to him, and it was his idea to sort of do it. And I wanted, you know, it's just a sneak peek. It'll only be for a few hours on that day.
That's right. July 13th.
July 13th, yeah.
Very cool.
And then we'll see. We're waiting for a world premiere. We're still waiting for it.
I highly recommend all three, Present Company, Audrey the Trainwreck, and Tiger Tail in Blue. I think everyone should check that out. And it's great that they're getting the showcase on that website. It's very cool. So.
Thanks.
Very cool. Thank you, Frank, for being here today. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. I hope it's good to listen to.
Sure.
I hope you enjoy it.
it's all about conversations, all just talking about independent film. And I think you did fabulous. So.
Thank you.
I think you did.
It's hard for me to focus. You know, it's easier for me to focus when I talk when I close my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to do that because I also feel like a pompous ass when I.
It's on a podcast, so no, it doesn't matter what your eyes are doing.
I should have just closed my eyes.
I think you had good eye contact
more.
As well. So no problem. So for all my recent reviews and interviews, visit HollywoodChicago.com. And to check out Frank Ross's latest work, visit NoBudgeFilms.com from July 11th to July 13th. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.